Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. The Western world's Ukraine project is facing some stark and probably insurmountable obstacles. Kyiv is failing badly on the battlefield. Western aid is reaching limits. And there has never been popular support for this elite-driven project. The biggest loser is Ukraine. Crosstalking Kyiv's dilemma, I'm joined by my guest, Brian Berletic, in Bangkok. He is a geopolitical analyst and a former U.S. Marine. In Lisbon, we have Alexander Guerrero. He is an international law analyst. And here in Moscow, we have Sonia van den Enden. She is an independent journalist. All right, Crosstalk rules, in effect, that means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Let me go to first to Brian. Brian, we have talked many times about Ukraine, this conflict, and more or less, I think you and I have been in agreement, and I think the trajectory that we saw for this conflict is playing out, because we're seeing the room for maneuver narrowing very, very much. We've had this budget issue in the United States, which has divided the Republican Party, and soon will divide the entire Western world. The interesting thing about the budget crisis in the United States and the election in Slovakia, which is the winner there, is questioning the entire Ukraine project. The important thing that's happened just recently is that you can talk about what is wrong with this policy. Debate is beginning to happen. 20 months in, but now you can actually, in polite society, debate this. Go ahead, Brian.
Oh, I think it's the veneer falling off of this entire project. Just like every other U.S. war of aggression or proxy war, it's always accompanied by huge amounts of propaganda, and that propaganda can only sustain itself for so long before the realities on the ground start to break through, people start to wake up to it. And when people begin waking up to it, they cannot go back to sleep. To these lies. And we have talked about the short supply of weapons and ammunition and how this proxy war was unsustainable, how Russia is ramping up its own military industrial production. All of this has made this unsustainable. The lies are not working anymore, and there's nowhere else to hide what is really happening. So now they have to confront it, and that's where things become very ugly.
You know, Alexandra, our guest in Lisbon, I've been watching the different narratives from the beginning. Democracy versus autocracy, Ukrainian sovereignty. This is all about China. You know, they keep changing their rhetoric. But the most recent one in the last few days is we need a pragmatic solution. I don't know what that means, but there was a pragmatic approach to this before the conflict started, and it was addressing the wrongs of the Minsk process, and Russia presented its own blueprint, and it was ignored. That was pragmatic. Go ahead, Alexander.
Yes, indeed. Well, actually, the European Union, even this week, are taking increasingly bold steps because they feel that the bet is going wrong and support is beginning to fail due to the exhaustion and lack of capacity to beat Russia due to fatigue. That's why they wanted to get together in Kyiv, and even the speeches used are absolutely bold and disconnected from reality. There is a widespread perception that people are beginning to realize that winter is coming. And this is a clear sign that the West is far from the right side of the story, because the dominant discourse continues to be characterized more by the anti-Russian message, by the Russophobia, rather than peace. For example, speaking about a European Union from Lisbon to Lugansk is just another desperate attempt to create a catchy message that will resonate with recipients and give them encouragement and confidence. They took advantage of Charles de Gaulle's message of a European economic area from Lisbon to the Urals, or Dmitry Medvedev's message of Lisbon to Vladivostok, constructive speeches that favor an area of peace and friendship, and suddenly we see the European Union making a speech demanding Russian lands. They no longer even discuss that Lugansk is Ukrainian. They want this to be a space controlled by the EU. And in the end, what I see only is that Borrell, what he described as being a garden like Europe, now is getting closer and closer of becoming the jungle.
Yeah, well, Sonny, this whole statement about Lisbon to Lugansk, that was Annalena Baerbock, and I just don't think she knows very much about geography, so I think it's more stupidity than a policy aim. But Sonny, one of the most important things that's happened, we had the Slovakian election, and we had the electorate there reject the EU's policy, NATO's policy when it comes to Ukraine, probably joining Hungary. There's a lot of rumblings in Poland, but that can be for different reasons because of the upcoming election here. But you can't talk about European unity anymore. I don't believe it was ever there because nobody ever voted on it. Sonia.
No, that's right. And also, yesterday there was a huge demonstration, and the day before, somehow last week, Unification Day, the 3rd of October, that is. There was a huge demonstration in Berlin because of unification of Germany in 1991. But after that, because they said around 30,000 plus people came, now today it was known that Scholz is not going to send Taurus rockets to Ukraine. So maybe they get a little bit frightened as well. And as you mentioned, yeah, this Baerbock type, she is so dumb. She even thinks there are 565 days in the year, I think. So. But I think the unification in Europe is—it's gone. And recently there was also an interview with an Ukrainian MP, and she said on Sky News that okay, everything went according plan, but they only gained 1% of land in the counteroffensive. And she also thought that the weapons from Europe, the flow now is stopped somehow. So they might postpone the whole counteroffensive until spring next year. So, I mean, this is clearly a sign. And there are more signs in the European Union that with coming winter, the people will rise up more, as we can see in Germany now. Even MPs in Germany are targeted. They are, the one is in hospital, and the other one, Alice Weidel, I think she went to Mallorca or something, but there's a lot of things going on, and unification for Ukraine, I think it's slowly but surely, it's gone, and it was never there. The Western part.
It was never there. So well put here. You know, Brian, we had Zelensky, and he does mostly PR work. I don't know what else it means to be president of Ukraine. But I think it was Italian media. He said he admits that, quote, there is fatigue. And of course, he's looking at the money trough and the spigot from the West, which is in question. I don't think, you know, that's over yet. I think there's the differences in the United States and the U.S. Congress will be resolved one way or another, and there will be more appropriations. Maybe probably not as much, but they will continue because the Democrats can't admit defeat on this. They want this war to continue. That's it. They don't want peace. They've never wanted peace, and they've only wanted a damaged Russia, which they're not getting. So they're just going to continue what they're doing. Brian.
And unfortunately, only a small handful of people in the U.S. Congress actually do want peace. A lot of people who are opposed to Project Ukraine are only opposed to it because it's not working out anymore. Its prospects look very dim, and they want to pivot toward China and then repeat this whole process with a nation with an even larger population, a larger military, a larger industrial base, and they want to start the process all over again. I think the money issue will be resolved, just as you say. I think the West is going to run out of arms and ammunition that they can send, and at least in sufficient amounts to Ukraine long before they run out of money. The U.S. prints money out of thin air, although this whole proxy war and the sanctions that accompanied it targeting Russia, this has put in danger the unipolar system, all of its financial mechanisms. It has served as a catalyst to spring multipolarism forward and help put another foot in the grave for unipolarism.
Yeah, Alexander, I guess one of the most mystifying things for me during this entire process is the position of Europe. I mean, all it does is damage Europe's economy, its prospects, and it's standing in the world, and I don't see it recovering. I mean, we have on this program, I refer to him as Sergeant Schultz. When he addressed the United Nations, nobody listened to him. Nobody wants to hear what the Europeans have to say in the Global South. Alexander.
And that's currently the situation even in the European Union. For example, if we take Germany as an example, an entire branch of the German economy the chemical industry, which provides jobs to more than 500,000 people, is on the verge of collapse. This is just one clear sign of what's happening to Europe. No one believes anymore on the European Union's leadership and European Union member states' leaders. Why? Because you don't have, you have no longer people like Charles de Gaulle, like other politicians from the 60s and from the 70s, real leaders. You don't even have a new Margaret Thatcher. What you have only presently is wannabes, people who want to be to create inspiration on the Europeans, but they lack the knowledge, they lack the charisma, and they know nothing about strategy. And that's why people are now showing signs of saturation. Polls reveal a growing weakening of European support for Ukraine, and now we are beginning to see cracks opening up in the longed-for unity. In the last few days, for example, we have seen a political change in Slovakia. That political change was strongly influenced by the situation in Ukraine. Even the situation in the United States, when I read the declarations by the Republican House group from the House against House Speaker Kevin McCarthy, he was overthrown. And one of the reasons expressly mentioned was the insistent support for Ukraine. Now we will see what happens on Sunday in Poland. But truth is, a little across Europe, we are beginning to see parties without much expression appearing as part of the solution. And they emerge as a possible solution because people are increasingly fed up with the debt and into which they have been pushed to. And this is presently the situation, for example, that even the financial situation in the West, to a large extent, is influenced by the agenda.
I'm sorry, I have to jump in here. We have to go to a hard break. And after that hard break, we'll continue our discussion on Kyiv's dilemma. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. To remind you, we're discussing Kyiv's dilemma. Let's go back to Sonia here in Moscow. Over the last couple of days, I've come across some very interesting, fresh demographic research into Ukraine. And by some estimates, not by all, but by some estimates, Ukraine's population is half it was in 1991, and it is getting smaller. It could reach the point of 20 million people. It had 50 million in 1991. So this is all what Western help is doing for Ukraine. Ukraine is experiencing a demographic catastrophe unlike anywhere else in the world. Sonia, here in Moscow.
Yes, of course. The half of the population, a bit lesser than the half, is gone to Europe, you know, they fled. I think about 4 million are now in Russia itself, I mean, like the regions, Moscow and so on. But I mean, there are so many people die, so many soldiers. We see all the, you know, on Telegram, you can see it clearly that Ukraine is losing badly on the battlefield. So that's also a big part. So yeah, maybe this is actually what they want. They want to empty a little bit Ukraine. And we heard already some rumors, maybe it's true or not. I cannot verify it myself, but they want to have the land in Ukraine because, you know, it's very fertile land. So the grain comes from there. We all know that. Of course, it's mainly from eastern part of what is now Russia, so the Donbas. But it's very sad to see that all these people are gone. And I mean, the majority, I think, will not go back to right. Ukraine or to parts of Russia at all. They will stay in Europe. So this is maybe the whole idea, because, you know, Poland has some aspirations for the western parts of Ukraine. That will be Poland, they said. They're already busy with that. So I think Ukraine will not exist anymore in maybe a few years or maybe sooner. We don't know.
Well, Brian, that, you know, this is something you and I have talked about from the very beginning. I think after everything is said and done, there will be some country called Ukraine, but it's certainly not going to be what it was in 1991, 2014, or 2023. Brian.
Absolutely. And I think this continues with the theme of who is the the biggest victim here and who is creating and driving all of this. From 2014 onward, the U.S. reshaped Ukraine into a battering ram to be used against Russia. It provoked this war deliberately. Their think tank documents talk about deliberately provoking Russia to extend it, overextend it. And now we see these terrible consequences playing out in Ukraine for the Ukrainian people. We also see the European economy taking a hit because of this, the sanctions, and then the United States itself essentially isolating itself on the global stage and sabotaging all of these advantages that it held economically, financially for decades. All of this tells us who is the real threat to the collective West. It is the United States and its foreign policy. It is not Russia, and it is not China beyond that. And as far as the fate of Ukraine, it's still very hard to tell. I think there could be some remnant remains of what used to be Ukraine, but I think Russia is going to continue pushing. They obviously have the advantage. They have no reason to stop. The West has not given them a reason to stop. Right now, I think it's still hard to tell, but what will remain is going to be very small.
Well, Alexander, whatever does remain after everything is said and done, it will be demilitarized. Let me repeat that. It will be demilitarized, okay? Russia is not going to allow NATO to do, you know, the Ukraine Project 2.0. They will not allow it. Alexander, also, Stoltenberg last week, he let the cat out of the bag. It was all about NATO expansion. I mean, it's really quite incredible, you know. Somebody has on the internet a montage of 3 minutes, of, you know, it's not about NATO, it's not about NATO. And then, well, of course, it's all about NATO. So at least, you know, they've drawn the curtain back on that. It's all about destroying Russia, okay? But is that what people really want, okay? I don't think so.
No. Actually, what I hear and what I read here and there is not the same as what the leadership of European Union and NATO actually are trying to spread. They are trying to inspire people in order to hate Russia, and that the most important thing is not to bring Ukraine up to the level, to the same level of, and quality of life that European Union had to be. But the main goal here is to finally defeat Russia, be able to defeat Russia, and then get the Western influence in Russia. This is the major message that they want to share. But in the end, what I would like to highlight is the fact that what you said, Peter, it's the militarization, not only of Ukraine, but presently Russia is demilitarizing NATO itself, because NATO countries are also losing their ability and their capacity even to protect and to defend themselves from a foreign threat. Even days ago, there was on the news something saying that even the Israelis had to help Germany to keep their air defense systems up and operational in order to allow that, in case of emergency, they would have the means to protect themselves. So this is one of the most important lessons that we get from here, is the militarization from NATO itself and losing the whole war or the conflict that they are presently waging and trying to wage against Russia. However, there is a good point here from the Russian side also, which is that Vladimir Putin and all the Kremlin, they are not going after the provocations that they are receiving from the Western side, because the West wants Russia to lose their minds and finally to get bold on this conflict. And they are quite moderately and patiently waiting for the European Union and NATO to demilitarize itself.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's been a huge question all during the conflict. What was the plan, the Russian plan? Because, you know, historically, they think of the Red Army as a steamroller going across Europe. Well, that has not happened, and it's a very different conflict than one would have expected. Sonia, you know, this militarization of Europe, I find it really interesting. First of all, I don't think voters want to pay for it, and I certainly don't think young men want to join up and fight Russia. I just don't see it. I don't see it with this younger generation at all. They may be politicized, but not on this issue. Sonia.
No way, especially the Western countries like Netherlands, Germany. I don't think they want to fight for even for Europe itself to, you know. So this is something what will not happen. The elites are planning in the European Union, or they talk about it, a European army, but I don't think it will get off the ground somehow. It will not happen. And the demilitarization of, I think it will happen from NATO a large part, because as we speak about it all the time, Europe is losing badly in this conflict. It's the US. I will always call Europe a colony from the US, but let's hope that this will change somehow, because, you know, Europe is destroying itself. And by all the weapons they have sent already the last 1.5 years, it's crazy. So they run out of weapons. And also, you know, the Nord Stream pipeline is gone. So Germany is a big mess. The country where I'm born, the Netherlands, this is another point. They are the most Russia-hating country, the elites are, because we have Bellingcat there. We have the MH17 disaster. Yep. So they still trying, you know, still trying and saying, because Rutte just promised to deliver F-16s. But the people, the majority of the people, they don't believe in it anymore. If they even believed it, I don't think so. So I don't see it happening. And I see it happening that they somehow will demilitarize. That's most likely will happen in the near future.
You know, and Brian, one of the, you know, you're a former U.S. Marine. I don't know what a part of the U.S. Marines you were in, but I mean, over the last year and a half, I mean, during the first summer of the conflict, the Ukrainian army was decimated. And after that, they started rebuilding a NATO army with Ukrainian soldiers. But the NATO equipment from all the various countries, they haven't acquitted themselves very well, and particularly the American ones, very expensive, but particularly useless weapons here. And this is a great embarrassment. That's why I don't think they want to send F-16s and stuff like that, because they'll drop out of the sky like flies. So they really acquitted themselves very badly. Very expensive junk. Brian.
Absolutely. There's so many factors that go into this. The fact that they sent a whole variety of equipment to Ukraine. They didn't just send one type of infantry fighting vehicle or armored personnel carrier or tank or artillery. They sent everything everyone has ever developed since the end of World War II. They sent all of that to Ukraine. Each one of those pieces of equipment requires different types of training, maintenance, in some cases, different types of ammunition and fuel. They have to coordinate all of this. It makes already complicated logistics even more complicated. The whole reason why militaries are standardized is to avoid this problem. And then you have the problem with training. I don't think people appreciate how much training goes into creating even a basic infantryman or tanker or artilleryman. They could take up to half a year to do. And they try to not just transform conscripts, Ukrainian conscripts, into a basic infantry or other basic roles. They try to create entire brigades with 4,000 men each and create it into a combined arms force. This is something that would take years. They tried to do this in 2 or 3 months, and the results are very predictable. Absolute catastrophe on the battlefield, and yes, a lot of destroyed NATO equipment.
Okay, Alexander, I'll give you the last word. What's the next step, Alexander in Lisbon?
The next step will be trying to get more radical speeches in order to bring down Russia, which is highly unlikely to happen in this minute. I'm not going to say that it is impossible, but it is highly unlikely. But what I see is that they don't have a way back. They can't exit. They don't have a clean exit here in the European Union and NATO. So they will try to continue providing support to Ukraine as long as their own economies and their defense systems allow. Otherwise, and then wait until there is some kind of point where they can reach out to Russia and finally celebrate any kind of peace deal. But presently—
Well, I mean, Alexander, what it'll be, I've already predicted it. They'll say, well, we stopped the Russians before they got it to Paris. We won, okay? They'll have some kind of crackpot line like that. Anyway, folks, we've run out of time. I want to thank my guests in Bangkok, Lisbon, and here in Moscow. And of course, I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. Remember, crosstalk rules.